Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. In 1748, a slave ship was heading back to England from Charleston, South Carolina, after having discharged its cargo of African natives. They were getting closer to home, just off the coast of Donegal, Ireland, when bam! The ship gets battered by a violent storm.
The wood on the sides of the ship start to break away and water's gushing in and they're trying to bail the water out.
The captain and the crew work frantically to patch the leak. The captain orders a man named John Newton onto the deck to steer the vessel.
He has to strap himself to the helm to avoid sliding down the deck. And I think it's in the midst of all that darkness and the raging storm and the rolling ship and the very real possibility that the ship was going to go down. I mean, this wasn't a false alarm. This was the real thing.
Steve Turner spent years researching the story of John Newton.
It's at that point that he becomes a Christian. You know, he vows that if his life is saved, that he's going to pursue this relationship with God.
Miraculously, the ship survives the storm. And John Newton keeps his word and devotes the rest of his life to the Christian faith. Well, that's part of the story. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them. It's the podcast where we tell stories from America's cultural divides. I'm Trey Kay. Today we're going to hear a story that I originally produced for the Public Radio International and WNYC program Studio 360. It's about a famous hymn that we all know. Something that's been sung by both religious and secular people. We'll hear how this song, which originally flowed from the pen of a slave trader, eventually became an anthem for civil rights. Now, you may know about John Newton, the author of the hymn known as Amazing Grace. And you might know about his harrowing conversion on the road to Damascus story. But as I learned producing this piece, many of the often repeated accounts of Newton's life are inaccurate, and some of them are wildly off the mark. Later in the episode, we'll learn more about the circumstances of his conversion, from being lost and then found. But first, how did this song that we all know come into being? So, 15 years after his near-death experience off the coast of Ireland, aboard a ship known as the Greyhound, health problems drove John Newton ashore for good, and he eventually found his way into the Anglican clergy. Newton became the priest of a small chapel in the English town of Olney. Over time, he began to write hymns to accompany his sermons. On New Year's Day, 1773, he introduced his congregation to a hymn that was inspired in part by his near-death experience at sea. It's called Faith's Review and Expectation, but it's come to be known by its opening phrase.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
That's Deborah Carlton Loftus, executive director of the Hymn Society of the United States and Canada.
Well, it wouldn't have been to the tune that we all recognize as associated with Amazing Grace.
Newton didn't write the tune that we know. Actually, he didn't write any tunes for his hymns. He wrote his verses in a common meter that could be sung to many different melodies.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound.
It's often said that Amazing Grace was written by an abolitionist. But John Newton wasn't an abolitionist when he wrote it. He never spoke of slavery from the pulpit. And it wasn't until 1788, 15 years after he wrote the hymn, that Newton finally spoke out against slavery, publishing an anti-slavery pamphlet, and becoming, finally, an outspoken abolitionist. But at the time, having written Amazing Grace wasn't his claim to fame.
Was Amazing Grace a popular hymn in England at the time that John Newton wrote it?
Actually not. It was not very well known, not considered in England to be one of his finest hymns, but it came over to the United States and picked up some usage and popularity in the revival meetings of the Second Great Awakening.
The Second Great Awakening was a Protestant revival movement that began around 1790 and continued into the late 1850s. It started in western New York and moved down through the Ohio Valley into Kentucky and Tennessee. Folks would travel in covered wagons from far away to camp for a couple of weeks, worshiping with preachers from various denominations.
Thousands of people would come together for these outdoor revival meetings.
Singing was a big part of these meetings.
There were choruses and refrains that people could learn quickly.
At the time, America had several schools that had the purpose of training teachers to help church congregations engage in the beautiful harmonic singing of sacred words. Enthusiastic, even ecstatic singing was the hallmark of these large camp revival gatherings. Music scholars believe Amazing Grace was sung at these revivals to many different tunes. William Walker was a singing teacher in South Carolina who published a songbook called Southern Harmony in 1847. That's the first documented instance when Newton's words were set to a tune called New Britain. Deborah Loftus says that back in the heyday of the revival meetings, it wasn't only whites attending.
We have documented that both free black persons and white people were together for these outdoor revivals, and there was a lot of interchange of musical styles.
These singing styles were passed on through the generations in African American families. We're hearing the singing of a family who are descendants of slaves that were featured in the 1990 Bill Moyers documentary about Amazing Grace.
Well, I think the song would have had a great attraction for the African slaves that were in chattel slavery, in bondage, in cruel, horrific oppression.
That's Reverend Matthew J. Watts, pastor of the Grace Bible Church in Charleston, West Virginia.
Amazing Grace would have spoke to their desire for an experience of freedom, of one day seeing God face to face, of being with him for all of eternity, and no longer subjected to the type of cruel treatment they experienced during slavery.
And we've been there 10,000 years.
Pastor Watts is singing a verse that today is often included in performances of Amazing Grace, but it's not something that was written by John Newton. That's because camp revival music leaders tended to do a bit of mashing up of hymns, singing them to different tunes, lifting verses from one hymn and singing them in another. That's what happened with Amazing Grace. In 1852, some of the verses written by Newton, along with the When We've Been There 10,000 Years verse, appeared in the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. Tom sings these Amazing Grace verses in his darkest hour. Author Harriet Beecher Stowe was the daughter and sister of revival preachers, and she may have heard Amazing Grace sung this way at a revival meeting. Some think her novel may have played a role in shaping how we sing Amazing Grace today.
So it's a moment of fusion between traditional, you might say, high society, white culture, and popular culture, black culture, revival, evangelical culture.
Jim Basker teaches English and history at Barnard College, and he's the editor of Amazing Grace, an anthology of poems about slavery. He says Stowe had met with runaway slaves, and she read slave narratives, and that she knew the song would resonate with African Americans.
So when she reached into that scene, and this is a moment of fusion between whites and blacks, it's a white woman author creating one of the most memorable black characters in all of 19th century literature, she reached for what would be the paradigmatic song from his soul that he might sing on his deathbed, and it's Amazing Grace.
The first recording of Amazing Grace was in 1922 by a group known as the Original Sacred Harp Choir. Around this time, the hymn was adopted as a folk song. And musicologist John Lomax and his son Alan were famous for capturing authentic folk performances, like this 1935 recording of Kentucky folk singer Aunt Molly Jackson. In the 1920s and 30s, there were the beginnings of a recording industry catering to the demand for songs appealing to a religious black audience. That's Reverend J.M. Gates' recording of Amazing Grace, which sold thousands of copies. And throughout the century, all of the great gospel singers would record the song, like Sister Rosetta Tharpe. During the Civil Rights era, activist Fannie Lou Hamer would lead protesters to sing songs like Amazing Grace, helping to define racial equality as a moral and religious pursuit. By the 1960s, white folk singers were finding their way to Amazing Grace, like Arlo Guthrie, who sang the song at Woodstock.
I once was lost, but now I'm found.
But Guthrie's version was not nearly as popular as one by another white artist who would soon follow.
My name is Judy Collins.
In 1969, Judy Collins was attending what she calls an encounter group, a kind of a self-help gathering where participants would express themselves, often being brutally honest. And at this particular meeting, things got contentious. Collins' record producer happened to be there.
And he said, you know, people are really at each other's throats. Isn't there anything you could do to settle them down? Why don't you sing something? And my grandmother was a church-going Methodist, and she had taught me Amazing Grace when I was a little girl. So I sang Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound.
It was one of the few songs that I knew that I figured everybody would know something of, and they all sang, and it did settle everybody down.
The next day, that same producer called and said, we have to record that song.
So I said, well, let's go into a church somewhere. And so we went up to the campus of Columbia University, And we went into the chapel. It's called St. Paul's. It's a gorgeous chapel. And we all got together and we recorded Amazing Grace.
Was grace that taught.
Elektra Records released Collins' recording of Amazing Grace on her 1970 Whales and Nightingales album.
My record company was flabbergasted. They didn't know what hit them.
The album went gold, and her recording of John Newton's hymn became a top 40 hit. And then it seemed like everybody, black or white, rock or blues or country, wanted to put their own signature on the song. Coming up, Amazing Grace returns home to England via bagpipes. Also, how much did John Newton's slave trade experience play a part in his conversion?
And that really is the kind of the lowest of the low period for Newton. You know, a wretch like me, that was the point in his life when he was at his most wretched.
I'm Trey Kaye, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
In difficult times, music gives us peace, brings us together, and helps heal us. It calms our nerves and brightens our days. That's why we're bringing you classic episodes of Mountain Stage on air and in our podcast. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find something that's familiar or brand new and feel the power of live music on our website, mountainstage.org.
Before the break, we learned how Amazing Grace, an 18th century Anglican hymn, eventually went to the top of the pop charts. Judy Collins' recording of the song was also a hit on British radio, which means that two centuries after John Newton penned it in England, where it had never really caught on, it was finally finding an audience. This caught the ear of a bagpiper from the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards, who was inspired to give Collins' arrangement a Highlander feel. The Dragoon Guards' recording of Amazing Grace also became a major hit in England, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and South Africa. Collins liked hearing her arrangement on the bagpipes.
And I am thrilled that it has now permeated the police and firefighters.
For centuries, bagpipes have been an important part of Celtic funeral traditions. But the Dragoon Guards' recording sparked the tradition of piping Amazing Grace at memorials for police, firefighters, and military. It's certainly a tradition New Yorkers know well, after the attacks on September 11, 2001.
I can hear it. You know, I live on the Upper West Side, and about a block from me is the Firefighters Memorial on Riverside Drive. And so every once in a while, we hear the bagpipes coming up from the river, and we hear them playing Amazing Grace. And we see like 5,000 firefighters out there in the street with their uniforms. It's an amazing thing. It's very moving. And it's, of course, the appropriate place for this song to go. I mean, it belongs in these situations because it is regenerating the idea of hope and forgiveness.
Amazing grace, how sweet.
And after a mass shooting at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, President Barack Obama offered the song's message of hope and forgiveness to the mourners.
A rain.
You know, Obama sings at the church in Charleston after the murders.
That's Steve Turner, the author of Amazing Grace, the story of America's most beloved song.
It's sung when policemen have funerals in New York. It just seems kind of like an all-purpose, hopeful song.
Barnard College professor James Basker says the song, both the musical notes and its lyrics, appeal to people at moments of intense suffering.
And they appeal without any narrowness. There's no specific condition, there's no specific religious faith, there's no specific cultural context. It's just about that thing that human beings share, which is pain. And the imaginative yearning, and this is the thing about human beings, we're able to imagine and to yearn for joy and peace, for relief from the miseries of this world. So it's the use of the human imagination, both the creative one that made the song and the receptive, interactive one that can identify with it, that lifts us up.
Throughout its history, Amazing Grace has spoken to Americans' belief in new beginnings and reinvention.
That's a very important part of the American mentality, you know, that you can start again, that you can come from nothing and succeed, and you can overcome a bad or dubious or hampering past. So all those things are in the song.
John Newton's writing of Amazing Grace might have been an attempt at a new beginning, a reinvention of his dark slave trading past.
He'd seen all angles of slavery, from going upriver and capturing people to, you know, the slave pens on Plantain Island, to being a captain. He knew the whole spectrum of the life of slavery.
It may have also been inspired by his time as a slave. That's right. Before he'd taken up with the Greyhound, the ship that almost sank, and before he captained his own slave ship, John Newton was a slave.
That really is the kind of the lowest of the low period for Newton. And I think when, a wretch like me, that was the point in his life when he was at his most wretched. You know, he was a British man on an African island, a long way from home, reduced to the position of a slave and actually being the slave of slaves, you know, in the sense that these slaves were taunting him and mocking him.
Having been both a slave and a slave ship captain, Newton would have understood both the us and them aspects of the slave trade. His deliverance aboard the slave ship Greyhound has been mythologized into a triumphant I've seen the light moment when he renounced slavery. But his abolitionist conversion was still years off.
He didn't leave the slave trade immediately. In fact, he went back to Liverpool and became the captain of a ship for the first time. And he did three voyages as a captain of a slave ship.
Newton would captain slave ships for another 14 years. During this time, he was devout to his Christian practice. But he never saw his work in the slave trade as being at odds with his religion.
So the slave captain is John Newton as a Christian, but he hasn't applied anything from his theology to the way they treat slaves. He doesn't see any inconsistency in being a slave captain and being a Christian. And he would conduct Christian services with his sailors, who he was quite concerned about their salvation and their spiritual discipline and everything. He was focused on the lives of his crew. But the wailing of the slaves below deck didn't really bother him.
Of course, during the mid-18th century, Newton's views towards slaves were not out of the ordinary.
People didn't have moral qualms about the slave trade at the time. I mean, very, very few people did. And I think that's because they had some idea that slaves were kind of people, but not really fully people.
Newton's firsthand experience in shipping slaves aided abolitionist William Wilberforce's drive to end England's slave trade, which was officially banned in March 1807. John Newton died just 9 months later.
Amazing grace.
A simple hymn written by a white slave trader, eventually turned abolitionist, took root among Protestant revivalists in the U.S., and then championed the cause for blacks seeking freedom and eventually civil rights. Perhaps by the end of his life, John Newton had experienced the grace that he had written about. where you can feel as though you are lost. And somehow know that you'll be found.
Now
I'm found.
What you say, girl?
But now
I'm found.
They still can't feel you.
But now
I'm found.
Was blind,
but
now
I see.
You've been listening to Us and Them. The original piece was produced by me, Trey Kay, Andy Newman, Jocelyn Gonzalez, and Louis Mitchell for the Public Radio International and WNYC program Studio 360. Additional production for this podcast by Lori Stern and Mitch Hanley. Joni Deutsch is our digital producer. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasoffi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide us with images for the web. Our intern is Nicholas Tantillo. All of the versions of Amazing Grace that you heard on this show can be found at our website, usandthempodcast.com. The marvelous people at West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. Hey, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.